Radio 4 Longwave now. It's time for an act of worship, led this morning by Canon Angela Tilby. Here on Radio 4 FM, the final episode from our Book of the Week, Reaching Down the Rabbit Hole. The neurologist Alan Roper recalls some of the more memorable moments in his early career.
On the first day of my second year of medical school at Cornell, I was sitting in the next to last row of a small, steeply sloped auditorium. A legendary cardiologist named Elliot Hochstein was on stage preparing to teach a course on physical diagnosis, how to properly examine a patient. For some reason, the lighting in the back of the hall didn't work quite right. So the stage, the speaker, and the first five rows were always in the light, while the back rows, though not dark, were dim. It reminded me of a baseball stadium when the sun cast a shadow across the infield. There were 89 of us in the entering class, and we were all in attendance. It was mandatory. 10 minutes into the lecture, I was startled by the weight of a heavy hand on my shoulder. It belonged to a guy with very long hair who climbed right over me, sinuously propelling himself like a cat into the next row, then over that row, and onward to the front. As he made his way forward, literally walking on all fours over one shoulder after another, our attention was drawn to a second, third, and fourth wave of the invasion. Several women crawled over the backs of our seats, followed by more long-haired men, the weirdest thing I had ever experienced. They swept over the entire entering class, crossing from the dark into the light, more than a dozen of them, and assembled loosely at the front of the auditorium, where they started belting out the anthem, Hair. It was the Broadway cast. Hochstein came up with the idea. The show's producer was his patient. They did the entire musical number, and after they left, Hochstein said to us, "What do you think?" A guy named Tori, a very talkative kid who always sat in the front row in order to ask inane questions, and who, of course, went on to become a Beverly Hills gynecologist, said, "Geez, that was an incredible experience." And Hochstein replied, "Exactly. The trick to medicine is to have it be an active experience, not to be a passive observer. Get in there fully with your senses, and then you'll be a great clinician. Look, listen, feel. Don't just stand there. A young woman patient comes in, and you're going to feel her liver, okay? You cannot think of it as an inanimate object. You're not feeling a block of wood. You know that kinesthetic sense of someone touching you? Like those actors moving you around, climbing all over you. That's what the patient feels. You've got to be in tune with them when you're doing that." When you start in medicine, before you go out onto the ward, you have not yet made the sociologic transition into being a doctor. Consequently, there are a lot of things that go through your mind that are uncomfortable. And many of us, including myself, began to take on patient suffering, especially when we treated patients who were dying of cancer. It was, and is not unusual, for these patients to identify everything other than their disease, including us doctors, as the problem. The elevators don't work. The food is lousy. The nurses are rude. What they're angry at is the fact that they have cancer, they're going to die, and nothing they or anyone else can do will change that fact. For a young doctor, it is all too easy to take that on and go home with it, and it can destroy you. To avoid this, we were required to meet individually and in small groups with a psychiatrist. Mine, a very prominent older therapist, was a dud, and I got very little out of our sessions. But one of my colleagues, a very empathic guy who eventually went into oncology, was more fortunate. In one of his sessions, he was sitting across the room from the shrink, articulating how much trouble he was having with his patient's anger, their problems, their complaints. The psychiatrist didn't say a thing, but he took a fancy fountain pen out of his shirt pocket and held it out in front of him, at arm's length, as though presenting it. He just held it there. My friend, who was about 26 at the time, got up from his chair, walked over to the psychiatrist, and took the pen. The shrink said, "Did you want that pen?" My friend said, "No, not really." "Then why did you take it?" "I thought I was supposed to take it." The patients are holding out their troubles. They are not really asking you to take them. You should only take them if you want or need to take them. Otherwise, leave it. They'll get along without your suffering. You have another job to do. A lesser therapist might have simply interrupted and said, "It's hard to know what's on a patient's mind, and you can't take on their troubles. You have to be able to distance yourself without being unsympathetic." All true, but without the pen, easy to ignore. The pen sold it. At about the same time, when I was an intern in San Francisco, we treated a farmer from the Sacramento area who had a form of meningitis known as valley fever. It is carried by airborne dust particles that settle into the lungs, causing a pneumonia-like infection that can develop into an inflammation of the brain's lining. The treatment involves a lumbar spinal tap that allows medicine to be injected into the spinal canal daily, a very invasive regimen requiring a long stay in the hospital. As serious as this was, the farmer had a more pressing problem. His wife was in the early stages of dementia, and she was alone on their farm with their two German shepherds. He desperately needed the treatment, and she desperately needed him. Every day when the team dropped by on rounds, the senior resident, whose name was Chin, told the farmer he was doing better, that his lungs were getting better. And every day, the farmer would reply by asking, "Can I go home today?" The first time this happened, Chin said, "You have to understand that you have a serious infection, and you have to get antibiotic injections for the next 2 weeks." On rounds the following day, when the farmer again asked his one and only question, "Can I go home today?" Chin went through it all again, but less patiently. 2 weeks. After several days of this routine, we were all frustrated, but Chin, who saw the world and all the people in it in the most literal terms, was beside himself. It became a problem. One of the residents on the team, name of Kravitz, was a bit of an amateur magician and also a talented pickpocket, undoubtedly the product of a misspent youth. Tricking people means knowing and controlling what's on their minds. That was Kravitz's real talent. One day, after yet another predictable Q&A with the farmer and during the ensuing Pavlovian decompensation by poor old Chin, Kravitz expertly snuck up from behind and lifted Chin's wallet in full view of all of us. He then suggested that we go down to lunch. He knew that Chin would offer to pay for everyone because we were interns, because he was the senior resident, because he was a very generous guy, and because Chin always paid. In the cafeteria, when he went to reach into his pocket, Chin said, "Oh my God, where's my wallet?" As he frantically rifled through his other pockets, we saw him run through a mental inventory. "I was in the lab, then I went to pathology, I was in the chairman's office, and now I don't have it." He started to flip out. The rest of us were by now seated at a table, everyone but Chin, who kept on about the wallet. Kravitz changed the subject. "Let's talk about the clotting cascade," he said, meaning a diagrammable sequence of reactions in the process of blood coagulation. As he started to draw it out on a napkin, Chin, whose job was to lead us through such lessons, said, "I can't concentrate on that. How am I supposed to concentrate on that? I can't find my wallet." Kravitz calmly stood up and said, "Here's your wallet. Now you know what that farmer feels like. He's got a demented wife at home roaming the farm half-dressed. No one's feeding the dogs. No one's feeding her. Do you expect him to focus on all this bullshit that we're telling him, when all he cares about is getting back to his wife?" Chin checked inside the wallet. We weren't sure whether he was going to thank Kravitz or kill him. Reading his mind, Kravitz smiled and said, "Oh, and by the way, thanks for lunch." As a fourth-year medical student, my mind was set on cardiology. I had gone to the National Institute of Health to do a cardiology rotation, at a time when that specialty was making a change from the classical approach, listening to the heart, to a technologically driven skill set. As soon as I realized this was the case, I started to think cardiology didn't need me. Then something happened that left no doubt that this was indeed true. Her name was Denise Arduzzi, a 22-year-old Portuguese-American woman who had lupus. She was in the ICU recovering from an attack when she became comatose. I can still picture everybody arching over the bed like a siege of herons, the kidney doctors, the cardiologist, and the rheumatologist, all of them struggling to keep her alive, but unable to figure out what was going on. Then an old-time neurologist, a wise old owl by the name of Robert Laser, showed up as the consultant, and the herons made way for him. He touched. He tapped. He turned her head from side to side, and when he was through, he looked up and said, "Basilar artery thrombosis." This was before MRIs, and just as CT scans were becoming available, and it absolutely blew me away. How the hell did he do that? "Give her heparin now," he said before he left. "Don't wait for an angiogram. Do that when you can, but give her the heparin now." They gave her the heparin, an anticoagulant, and she got better. Eventually, they did the angiogram, and what do you know? She had a thrombosis in the basilar artery. A stroke. Sometime later, I caught up to Dr. Laser to tell him how impressed I was, and he said, "Well, that's what neurologists do." In Denise Arduzzi's case, what he did was to see what everyone else had missed, that her eyes rested downward and did not move when he rotated her head to one side and then to the other. He deduced from the hard wiring of the eye movement pathways that this must be a problem in the upper and mid brain stem, and, ergo, a blockage of the artery that supplies it with blood. That's when I said to myself, "This is for me." In those days, medical students tended to be down on neurology. You couldn't do much of anything in the way of cure or even prevention, so you just sent patients back out on the street. Treat 'em and street 'em is how they put it. Then I went to a talk given by my future mentor, who happened to be visiting the hospital, Raymond Adams, one of the greatest clinical neurologists of the 20th century, gave an overview of where neurology stood in medicine and, more importantly, where it was headed. I can remember his advice to this day. Think about it. There are more diseases of the muscle, just the muscle, which is a tiny sliver of neurology, than there are all the diseases of the lungs. There are more diseases of the spinal cord than there are of all the diseases of the heart. Neurology has more diseases and more complexity and more need for exquisite clinical analysis than any other branch of medicine. So, if you really want to be challenged instead of being bored in 7 years, you may wish to consider neurology. As another wise neurologist told me early on, "You want to be a nephrologist or a urologist? Come on! The kidney? It makes urine. Now the brain makes poetry."
Reaching Down the Rabbit Hole, Extraordinary Journeys into the Human Brain was written by Alan Roper and Brian Burrell. It was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Colin Stinton. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. Next week's Book of the Week is Will Boast's moving account of loss and long-held family secrets. Epilogue, a memoir, begins on Monday at 9:45.
Of course, no one accused the old woman of being a witch.
Suburban suspicions of a gingerbread house.
She should have used an English recipe, like shortbread or Swiss roll. I bet she won't pay council tax.
Fear of the unknown in modern-day fairy tales.
The post office closed down, and the high-speed broadband connection date was postponed, and everyone began to see a pattern in the configuration of events.
Sweet Home by Caris Bray. 5 short stories next Monday to Friday morning at 11 over on BBC Radio 4 Extra.